Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Michael Reblot, who is the CEO of Forder. Michael, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me again, Karen. Always great to talk to you.
It's likewise, and it's always so much fun because you give us a really interesting perspective on an issue that is plaguing retail, cybercrime, and we're seeing more and more of it as more and more volume moves online, of course. So let's start with an obvious question. We're on the other side of the holiday season where there were many opportunities for the cyber criminal to wreak havoc. Did they?
In some cases, but all of our customers have succeeded to go through the holiday season really, really well. We kept the fraudsters at bay and made sure that all the good customers can get what they want. I think it was a very, very successful holiday season for us. We've actually seen several of our customers drive their sales spike to 4-0 times than the regular, and you see a lot of tension. They ran a really good promotion. So the influx of orders caused a lot of tension in the whole system, and I'm very, very happy that we were a crucial part in their success there and enabled them to focus on what's important to fulfilling those orders for their customers. There is always an issue before the holiday season, where will the system hold, right? You do a lot of efforts. The retailers do a lot of efforts on their end, and we do a lot of efforts from our end. Yeah, I was extremely proud of the fact that we had zero issues, literally zero issues, no downtime, no nothing during the holiday season, and we were able to support all of our customers just flawlessly.
So wow.
I'm very happy about that, and we'll have to maintain that next year.
Well, congratulations on that. I want to remind those listening that your business model is very unique in that you take on the risk of basically authorizing the transaction, authenticating that that is, in fact, the person who is representing that they are a legitimate customer and not a fraudster. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if something goes wrong, it's on you. So obviously, in order to do that, you have to have a great team, and core to your team, I'm sure, are fraud analysts who are extremely good at what they do. So tell us, what makes your fraud analyst extremely good at what they do?
Well, first, I think a fraud analyst is a very broad title, and I think in our company, we probably have 6 or 7 different types of what we would call analysts. It's just an easy term for us to use. But kind of the general role of a fraud analyst is understanding what a fraudulent case or a fraudulent story or a fraudulent scenario looks like, how to find the clues for it in the data that we're collecting, and then how do we generalize it into and teach a machine to make decisions instead of us. So something that is very, very important about our system versus, I think, everyone else in the industry is that 100% of the decisions we make are made automatically. So fraud analysts in Forder, actually, they don't review transactions and they don't make decisions. The system does that, so the analysts are the ones teaching the system what they know and what they find in the kind of results of their research and a review of all the interesting transactions that they see after the system has made a decision to make sure that the system can support that in real time. Real time is important here. And no matter how good of an analyst you are, you can't make a decision within 300 milliseconds.
Now, that would be a really fast and good analyst.
Yeah.
So let me go back to what you said. So you said what a fraud analyst does is understand how to identify fraud and looking for clues in the data. So how does one become very good at that? Or are there innate skills that fraud analysts need to have full stop in order to be very good at their job?
Yeah, so I think there are kind of two parts. You need to have skills and you need to be well-trained and you need to have a lot of experience doing it. Experience is an important part in becoming a great analyst. I mean, after you've seen a few hundred thousand transactions and you've seen a few hundreds of different scenarios and you made some errors in judgment, it makes you better. But if we start from the beginning in terms of the skills that are required, so a lot of the analysts that we hire, it may be their kind of first job out of the Israeli intelligence or first job after their finished a degree in psychology. And then the skills we look for are extremely high, let's call them, for the lack of better words, analytical skills, which means looking at a lot of details and finding the pattern that connects them. But you also have to have a really creative thinking, because a lot of the time, the first pattern that comes to mind is just wrong. It derives from something else you can't see in the picture, and you have to be able to think of different scenarios. During our initial screening of analysts, and I think our ratio of people that come to interviews to analysts that we actually hire is about 100 to 1.
Wow.
So it's a very, very long process from our standpoint, and a very selective one. And we get great candidates to begin with, but for to be able to successfully do that, you really need exceptional people. And one of the first tests we give them is we present them with a case of, so we have different scenarios there, but a case of you have different people that you know something about them, and you have different outcomes in the world that those people have created, but you don't know which is which, and you have to connect them. But you have only 60% of the information, so you have to make a lot of assumptions, but you need to make sure that the data corresponds with the assumptions 100%. Like, it can't be, if you see something, it's like kind of physics, if you see something in the world and your theory doesn't explain it, then the theory is wrong, not the observation.
Right.
You have to collect that. So physicists are actually interesting analysts. So it's important for people to be creative. It's important for people to be observant with a really good eye for detail, because there are a lot of small things that you may miss, and then they can turn the whole story around. It can be something trivial when you look at a transaction of switching the daylight saving time on your computer, because most of us, it just happens automatically because we connect properly. But if you're trying to pose as someone else and you switch the time zone, but you forgot that, let's say in Arizona, they don't have daylight saving, then the whole story falls apart. So an eye for detail is very, very important. Patience is as important as a general trait. A lot of the time, you have to go through a great number of transactions and different patterns, and you have to constantly educate yourself of what's going on in the world, why is it relevant. You see a certain pattern from Venezuela, and you'll have to go outside of your box and your list of transactions to find out a response to this, which in the particular case that I'm thinking of, Venezuela has a restriction on the number of U.S. dollars they can spend. So you see a spike in foreign transactions, cross-border transactions from Venezuela in December, because they all try to sell their quota or exercise their quota. And without learning about this, you will never find that on your own. So
Wow. There
are a lot of different skills you have to have there.
What's interesting, you mentioned physicists make good analysts. I often wondered what physicists did, but you also mentioned 6 or 7 different types of fraud analysts. So help us unpack that a little bit. Where does a physicist fit in the profile of a fraud analyst?
So the basic analyst looks for patterns in the data, and a physicist looks at observations and tries to construct a theory that or a formula that will explain those observations. Then it's kind of the same process, different domain, but the similar process. So let's call that kind of the generic analyst. We actually have a fraud analyst that used to be like majored in anthropology, because we need to understand different cultures. Something that will be considered a good behavior in Vietnam will be considered a very bad behavior in the Philippines. So you can't just say, well, all the Southeast Asia countries are the same. They're not. They have different culture, different behaviors are treated as good or bad. Like in some countries, it's very common to have a Facebook page that is shared by 6 people, and in others, everyone has their own profile because they treat privacy differently. So it's important to understand that. And then we have psychologists that kind of supplement and sociologists that supplement that understanding. We actually have a biologist that does a lot of what she learned and she did in the past to do with kind of genetic evolvement of models, because we can try to track how processes evolve or how natural behaviors evolve and connect that. Of course, we have the web hacker, because a lot of the data we collect is from your device, from your network. We see a lot of fraudsters trying to hide themselves, so that's important. We have pure, let's call them kind of hardcore intelligence operatives. that create fake identities in the dark web to try to extract information from fraudsters, which is a completely different skill set than the physicists we talked about in the beginning. So it's a complete operation assembled from many, many very different but very talented people. So that's why I can't give you a generic fraud analyst description. It's a surgically assembled team, which I'm extremely proud of.
You should be. It's a fascinating lineup. And when you think about, as I'm listening to you go through the various categories, you have a biologist, and I thought, what the heck? You know, the physicist was a head-scratcher biologist, but these things are viral. You know, so you think about how these things spread and what stops the spread. So I can intellectually now make the connection. But how did you come to determine that this ecosystem within your environment was what you needed to make the analysis of fraud robust? Because a lot of what you see in traditional, you know, fraud businesses is the pattern analysis, but certainly not to this degree.
Well, we've been in this area for many, many years. We started a lot of the early employees, and I actually think it's more than 50% of the employees in Porter right now, are used to be part of the Israeli military intelligence. So we were trained in the army to look for patterns, to search for terrorism or weapon smuggling or whatever the intelligence task they were at hand, which is similar in concept to finding fraudulent activity. Right? You have bad behaviors done by criminals, like professional criminals or terrorists, and they try to cover their track and they try to look as legitimate as possible and use kind of the loopholes in the screening mechanisms and so on. But then we work for other companies in the field in cybersecurity and fraud in PayPal. So we've seen billions of transactions and many, many different scenarios. So as I started with, experience is important. And through many years, over 15 years, each of us being in those in this field, you learn and through trial and error of what works and what doesn't. And you experiment a lot. So we try a lot of things that don't work to find out those things that do. And then you double down on the things that do and kind of keep the cycle of experimenting and learning from. And but we have a very different economics than almost anyone else that deals with fraud, because we offer a service to all the retailers. Spending $1 million on to research a new pattern or a new technology, or even getting it wrong for a while and then finding a way to do it, is something that is worthwhile for us, because then it makes the whole system better and all of our clients better. But any single retailer will never spend that much money, because his individual problem is not big enough and he doesn't actually have the skills or the pain to do that. And traditional vendors in the fraud prevention space usually came through, they had one idea and they doubled down on that idea, and they assembled a team that was very, I would call, like-minded people to just execute that one idea extremely well. And we took a different approach of, let's go as broad as possible and create a really, really large assembly of tight nets that through the combination of them will just be way more accurate. So you need a variety of disciplines.
So you also mentioned that 100% of your decisions are done through automation. So not a single decision is touched by a human, although these humans are very important to making the machine smart. Describe that process for us a little bit, obviously without giving away the secret sauce.
No, it's okay. Some of the analysts are doing what we're calling a gap analysis, right? So they're looking, the system flags transactions as interesting, as potentially there is some new pattern about them. So we have a lot of machine learning involved, kind of running as part of this, to dig up transactions that may be interesting. And it can happen 10 seconds after the transaction occurred, or it can happen a month after the transaction occurred, because we learned some new information. A repeat buyer trying to do that, or we've got a chargeback from it, or something happened. And then analysts would look at those transactions, try to understand why the system made the decision that it did, and try to compare it to what they would do if they would have the time to make the decision originally, and then they try to find the gap between the quality of the decision of the system in real time and what we think of now, and then we improve the system, which is also another very important advantage we have in the way we constructed the system. Usually, fraud prevention systems are based on complicated models that are trained once every 3 months or once every 6 months for various reasons. But we train and or deploy changes to the models and to our production system probably 5, 6, 7 times a day.
Wow.
So the way it's constructed, from every single mistake we make, we can be better. And then there's a team that constantly looks at things as they happen, and we're able to adapt 10 minutes later. So the internet changes so fast, and the fraudsters adapt so fast, then you have to be able to respond immediately. And it took us a while to develop that capability, and I think it's a really good, really important advantage we have to provide the system that is as accurate as ours.
You know, I think about the profile of your recruit, you know, it is certainly very diverse, and all of those parents who have educated anthropologists must be really excited to know that there's the possibility that, you know, there may be a role to play in fighting, you know, cybercrime. In all seriousness, it's an interesting recruiting profile, but I'm curious to get your thoughts on, as the discipline of cybersecurity becomes something that is either introduced in college curricula or, you know, at the graduate level, do you see any of these fundamental principles being introduced anywhere that cybersecurity or cyber, you know, forensics is being introduced into that kind of curricula?
So, firstly, I know in Israel we actually have cybersecurity in high school.
Really?
It's a class that you can take in several high schools. There is a program for college for this. I actually think in the U.S. there are several places that are deploying this as well. The world is becoming more and more digital, and it's not only in commerce, right? Through the internet, we can probably control 95% of our functions, from water to electricity to national security, anything you can think of, and securing them is crucial. And you follow all of the different hacks of the different systems that occurred in a growing frequency.
Yep.
And the fight there is not just for information or money, but it's also for physical control of systems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So cybersecurity is becoming extremely important and will become more and more important. So I'm actually very happy to see that it's being introduced into education systems. It's not a byproduct of some engineers in the Silicon Valley. People should be more aware of it and better prepared for it. And I think as a career standpoint, if you're now in college, cybersecurity isn't going anywhere.
Right.
So it'll be a safe bet to go that way if it interests you and if it's a good skill.
So final question. It sounds like you know, obviously a lot of where you're recruiting is in Israel because there is this, in the compulsory army intelligence, there's this very much in the DNA of those who serve in the Israeli army, looking at terrorism and weapons tracking and trafficking, just because of where Israel is situated in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But how common is it for other countries that are thinking about cybersecurity at the very highest level, so securing systems that would be extremely bad to fall into the hands of cyber criminals, so Homeland Security and the National Security Agency. How common is it for them to have their fraud analyst have the same sort of profile, team profile that you've put together? Or are you guys unique?
I think in military-grade technologies, so if you're looking at whether it's the Israeli intelligence or the NSA or other organizations, they tend to work in a similar way. There are some differences. We've actually worked with several, in my previous capacity, we've worked with a lot of intelligence organizations. But the big difference is that in Israel, as you mentioned, army service is mandatory, and everyone in the country has been there, and they see it as a common trait for people. And in the U.S., unfortunately, there isn't enough of a migration of people from defense or intelligence-related professions into the civilian life. So I would like to see more ex-NSA agents in security startups or more police cyber unit experts or just scholars that study those things in the universities. I think Georgetown has a program that to do something with about cyber security or cyber defense in general. And I would like to see them be more integrated in Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley has some, or at least has, I think it's changing now, finally, a notion of every problem can be solved with engineers.
Right.
And it just doesn't work that way. You need different people. Diversity is good for you. It's not bad for you.
Right. Well, Michael, as always, it's a fascinating conversation that could go on for, you know, many hours, but I've kept you long enough. I do appreciate the insight about the way you not only look at fraud, but how you've assembled your team of analysts to really understand, as you point out, the patterns of fraud, looking for the right clues in the data, but doing it in a way that protects your interests, certainly, and those of the retail customers you serve. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And we'll have a great and very interesting year.
I believe we will. And Happy New Year to you, too. Thanks again.